You're listening to the Meet the Farmers podcast with me, Ben Eagle. To listen to previous episodes, visit thinkingcountry.com or find the podcast on iTunes by searching for Meet the Farmers. Hello and welcome to episode 22 of Meet the Farmers. My guest today is George Young, an arable farmer from near Basildon in Essex. Would you say you're near Basildon, or would you say you're near Brentwood or Southend? Because you're sort of...
Unfortunately, Basildon is the correct near location.
George farms about 1,400 acres, of which 1,200 is cropped. Cropping generally comprises winter wheat, winter beans, spring peas, oilseed rape and linseed, as well as a few experiments, George's words, including buckwheat and lentils, which he grows for the pioneering pulse and grain marketeer, Hodmedods. He's also growing YQ Wakelands population wheat, which he aspires to mill and bake himself. Before moving back to the family farm at the age of 27, George worked in oil trading for Barclays, as well as being a semi-professional musician. George, thank you so much for speaking to me today. Can you start by just giving me some family history of the place? How long has your family been farming in this area?
My family generally has been farming forever, on both sides really. We moved down, or the Youngs moved down from Scotland in 1895 to very, very close to here.
And so along with all of Essex's other farms.
Exactly. And we actually moved to Giffords Cross Farm in Corringham then, which is a mile away from where we are now. Family actually did briefly go out farming in the 20s, and then at the time when farming was at its worst, I had a great-grandfather and great-uncle who thought it was the ideal time to enter into farming there, but they ended up moving to Corringham Hall, which is just down the road from us now. And then in 1954, we moved to Curtis Farm and Fobbing Hall Farms, which is the farm here in Fobbing.
And you came back to the farm after quite a different career, let's say that. Why did you come back?
Oh, that's a question I ask myself every morning. The ultimate decision came down to the fact that banking, which is where I was, just wasn't allowing me to do enough of what I wanted in my life. I thought it was about time to bite the bullet and come back into farming. I mean, I almost actually considered doing a year as a professional musician in London, but decided against that. And it was just a decision to say, well, do I want to carry on trying to work in finance and do a little bit of work in farming, or do I want to just go full on into farming? And that was the decision I came to, which has been an awful lot of learning and a lot of fun, and then times were not so much fun, but you know.
Tell me about the business, because you've got a fairly typical rotation, but then you've also got this exciting stuff on top, which so there's the relationship with Hodmedods, for example.
Yes.
Did you get into growing things like lentils and buckwheat?
So this is a very recent thing. So
By you?
Yes. Yeah. So this is our first year growing lentils and buckwheat. And actually, I've wanted to grow buckwheat for 4 years now, something like that. Originally, I found out about someone growing buckwheat. I think it was actually Simon Charles I originally spoke to at an organic day at the Organic Research Centre. I've got this big thing about going to organic days. Great way to find out about farming, to go to organic days. And someone had grown buckwheat, and then you hear about these fantastic properties of buckwheat, with the fact it can mine phosphorus and it's got this herbicidal property and all these kind of things. So it seems great, and you plant it pretty late in the spring, so it's a useful crop. And then as well as that, every single fancy little pot you get from a supermarket or from Pret or anything like that has got buckwheat on top. So I think, well, hang on, why is all this buckwheat being grown in France and Russia and Canada? I want a little bit of that. And so it took a really long time, because I didn't want to be doing, I'd found people where I could grow buckwheat for seed, for cover crops. But for me, that's really boring. There's nothing exciting about that. For me, it's always been about wanting to be able to grow food crops. And almost my biggest frustration as a farmer is the fact that we don't grow food crops, we grow commodity crops. And a lot of these commodity crops are even something like, you know, feed grains, which is one of the most stupid things that for some reason humanity thinks is a good idea, to go and feed grain to animals that eat grass. It's ridiculous.
Is that one of your aims here then in the long term, to try and move as much as possible? Because obviously on a farm this size, it's not going to be 100% possible to move away from commodities.
Precisely. So it definitely won't be anything like 100%. If I'm honest, I mean, we grew 2 hectares of buckwheat this year.
Yeah.
1 hectare of lentils and 1 hectare of the Wakelands wheat.
But you've got to start somewhere.
Which, you know, which is nothing. I'm hoping to potentially be able to expand maybe up to... It's not going to be very much, but it might be 10 hectares of one or something like that. It will be a very, very small proportion of the farm, but it will be the proportion that A, should have a reasonable margin, and B, will actually be exciting to grow. There'd be something super cool about, like, actually seeing a genuinely finished product, yeah, where you've seen the life cycle of that product. You put that in the ground. Those are the things that really, really excite me as a grower. And to be able to call myself a grower as opposed to a farmer, that's where I think the word grower kind of fits better.
What's the difference for you then between growing and farming?
Farming, it just... I don't know. It just feels more kind of industrial. It feels like it doesn't necessarily feel like you're so touchy-feely. So an example is with wheat. I would argue that most people who grow wheat, which I'm talking about milling wheat, really. Most people who grow milling wheat don't have a clue about baking. And I think if you don't know anything about baking, then how can you know how to grow a good crop of wheat? I've been reading a fantastic book by Vanessa Kimball, who's this. She's really, really good on Instagram, actually, with her bakery stuff. She's a baker, but she's really into the growing side of it as well, interacting with farmers. And reading her book, there's just really interesting, simple stuff. Like, apparently, by putting dung on before you grow the wheat, you really engender specific microbes that are fantastic for making an even better sourdough starter. Really simple stuff. Why would you ever know that? But it's those little kind of small details which will enable you to grow better, tastier, more interesting food. And that's what, yeah.
I put a little tweet out last night telling people that I was doing this with you today. And Ed Forge, who farms quite near you here,
yeah, I know Ed,
came back and said that you're one of the farmers that he knows who probably reads more than anyone else he knows. Is that important to the way you farm?
I tend to find I read more and know less and less all the time. It's not always the most useful thing to read lots. I'll say this much, because it can be bamboozling. And I think I've been massively into finding out all this stuff. And to be honest, it's actually less reading and more watching videos online. Yeah, yeah. And that's the best way I find to ingest media. I'm a very slow reader, so it's not the best way for me to do it. I suppose the one that I've always wanted to do that, because I feel like I've missed so much farming education.
Yeah.
When I came home at 27, I didn't have a conventional farming upbringing. I mean, I did. I lived on a farm and all that, but I wasn't sat on a tractor at 15 or 16 doing corn cart. I barely drove a tractor. I probably had put 2 hours on a tractor until the age of 27. So I genuinely knew nothing about farming.
Without stopping you mid-flow, though, do you think that might have helped you in some ways?
Absolutely. I think it's a really a really key factor to me being able to come in without any preconceptions, yeah, is that. But similarly, I feel that, or I've especially felt when I was back in the first few years, like I just had to read and find out as much about all these different, yeah, farmers just to have some kind of backup to me. Because I thought, well, I know nothing at 27. Yeah, I need to have something to know about. Yeah,
yeah. Can you tell me about your Wakelands population wheat? So I've done a bit of research before I came to you on this, because I have to say I hadn't come across it before.
I'm not surprised.
can you give me some more detail about it?
Wakelands, it's known as YQ, which just stands for yield and quality. Yeah, exactly. That's like the cool, you know, I'm growing YQ. Yeah. Then only the people in the know what they're talking about.
Yeah,
you've
got to give it a fancy name.
So it was developed by Wolf, and basically he took 20 grains from... I can't actually remember which one it was, but one of these grain repository places that stores all these ancient grains.
Yeah.
And there are a few people doing this with different types of ancient grains now as well. Essentially, he took 20 and he insured 20 crosses, but done naturally, obviously, rather than genetically. This is all done, I believe, in partnership with the Organic Research Centre, or certainly they're the ones who've got the licence on it as such. So obviously, when you've crossed 20 and 20, you get 400 species of wheat then. And then he's grown that on for a couple of years. And then my Wakelands ended up coming from someone called Mark Lee, who farms down in Shropshire. Really interesting organic farmer. So the idea behind this is that rather than growing... Conventionally, you would grow a variety of wheat. So every single wheat plant in the field is genetically identical. Which obviously, if you look at any kind of biology, is a ridiculously stupid thing to do. Yeah. And is a reason why we have to be out with fungicides and insecticides and all this stupid stuff we seem to think is okay to use on crops nowadays. So to kind of flip that completely conversely, obviously, by growing a population wheat where every single plant in that mix is genetically unique, over a period of time, the aim is obviously to always home save seeds. It's absolutely critical to home save seed because you will breed for a, obviously not a variety, but a population of wheat that really likes growing on your soils, in your environment, all those kind of things, and is really robust and resistant to these things. So you might one year have an outbreak of yellow rust, but it might take out 20%. And then the other 80% aren't affected and bulk up and fill in the gap and it's not a problem. So it's all about that resilience and robustness. And then you've got some cool kind of side effects to that. And this is what got me really interested in it, is the idea of saying, well, obviously, because you've then bred a population that grows on your farm, you then have a flower that is a taste of fobbing. So, and similarly, someone else over a number of years growing it in another part of the world would have a taste of whatever village they're from. So it's about this kind of bringing food production back to kind of a locality and having a genuinely really cool taste to that.
So what are your aspirations with it?
Hopefully I've got a couple of homes who are going to take a large amount of it.
Yeah.
I need to source a cleaner. So it's funny how you realise all these things. Sometimes it's always best not to think too hard or you'll never do anything.
Just start and work it out afterwards,
exactly. So I need to source a cleaner to clean it. There's a little company called Komo, K-O-M-O, that do little flour mills.
Okay.
The trick, this again, according to Vanessa Kimball, you must have stone mills. It can't be put through a stainless steel roller mill or you don't get the right microbes and things like that in the flour. Again, who knows why, but
trust Vanessa.
Exactly. So these Komo are some kind of stone ceramic mills. The thing with the flour is you can't, my original thought was, oh, I'll just go and send it up to Marriages and they'll do a batch and send it back to me in 20 kilo sacks and that'll be sorted. And then I did more research on flour and found out that flour must be used in the period of milling where it's either 1 week up to 3 months old. So it's way too lively in the first week, then it chills down a bit, but after 3 months it's chilled down way too much. So I can't even just go and get the whole quantity milled. So it's like, right, so in which case I need to clean it, keep it in a trailer somewhere, and then mill what I need. And then this is then the extension, which will depend somewhat on my time. But what I'd like to do in terms of connecting my local community to what is growing on the land they look out their window onto, is I like the idea of maybe doing something along the line of a subscription bread model, mm-hmm. whereby someone will subscribe to one or two loaves of sourdough. I would only produce one product, which would be sourdough. If you're making one loaf or you're making kind of 10 loaves a day, there's not a huge difference in time. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, sourdough is one of these funny things if you ever bake it, where it's actually easier to make it every day rather than making it once a week. Because you always refresh your starter every day. It might be kind of a cool little interesting business and who knows where that goes. Yeah. That's where I'm thinking at the moment.
I mean, this kind of thing isn't down every farmer's street. And one of the issues, what I can see still with these kinds of seeds on a European level, is the marketing side. And in the small bit of research that I did, so there is a European-led temporary marketing experiment for certain grains, which gives a license to market these grains, that runs out in December of this year. Can you explain that whole issue?
Yeah, I only actually found out about this. It was at an organic day I went to in May or June, I think it was. This was so basically that I think if this is the same thing that I think you're talking about, it's the idea that you're not allowed to sell population wheats.
Yeah,
it's just not allowed.
Yeah.
And they somehow, the Organic Research Centre managed to get something pushed through. I don't actually think for what I'm trying to do it matters.
Oh, exactly.
Because I can do what I like on my farm and I have the product. I really hope these are the types of things that change because, see, unfortunately, it doesn't work towards big business. And I think the way that all farming has been geared is actually, it hasn't been geared by farming. It's been geared by big businesses lobbying government to do certain things. It makes sense for large flour mills to be able to get very, very consistent batches of flour, which is why, and then they can mix that to their specification, where every single year it's always identical with identical protein figures and all these things. unfortunately, I mean, we're so far down the track of that line of thought in business and in government that the backtrack is, I doubt, possible. But I really hope that the legislation that was put there to steer in that direction is relaxed to enable a kind of backdoor system whereby people can carry on experimenting with this and there is a market for it. And because I think this is a thing, I talk to, I'm obviously fortunate to have a lot of non-farming friends. If I go out in London, there are people who know nothing about farming. Now, if you talk to them about growing wheat, they might be kind of interested. But then when you figure in the ecological side that I talked to them about and then kind of these stupid little projects that I'm working on, that's when they get really interested. So I think a lot of people probably think it's a complete folly, the idea of me trying to go and do this subscription bread thing. But it's,
everyone hates an innovator.
Well, it's not innovating. It probably is folly. But it's not so much about trying to make that business viable. As long as that business doesn't time suck too much from my life and isn't profit losing or loss making, provided that's the case, then I would be happy to know that there is some kind of positive marketing effect of that about British farming and about kind of innovation in looking at farming and not about my farm, but just about farming in general, to make people realise that you don't just grow crops. There is a story behind it and a story that people are interested to tell. It's the type of thing, if someone came to a dinner party and there's a loaf of this YQ bread and they've been told about that, they would want to explain to their dinner guests about that and why it's cool and where it came from and all that. That's what's really exciting and gets people interested in farming and connected with farming. I mean, most people are 4, 5, 6 generations removed from farming now. It's ridiculous. Yeah. And it's not even like back in the 50s, people used to have a holiday to go and go hop picking or you know, fruit farming, whatever. That was their summer holiday with their kids. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. So there is no connection to farming. It's trying to get that personal connection back again.
Because there is, and has been, very recently, a growth in food culture.
Yes.
And people are very interested in food. So how do farmers take advantage of that and link the two? Huge question.
That's a really, really big question.
I love launching big questions on my guests.
this is whereby I think the social media thing is very, very important.
Yeah.
And it's something that... originally, I did a lot on Twitter, and then you realise the more you do on Twitter, it's very farmer focused. So you end up in a group of farmers, and there aren't many non-farmers who are attached to that. So you think, well, that's not very useful. My biggest revelation actually was, so I do a lot on Instagram now. My handle is Farming George, which is on every platform. And I really like Instagram because it's picture based, and I like it because you can do the picture, and I'll always write a detailed explanation. And if someone wants to read the explanation or not, at least they had some kind of link. But I didn't realise how many people were using Facebook still.
Yeah.
And the thing I found with Facebook is that, so I just linked my Instagram to my Facebook, and suddenly I got all these questions from these non-farming friends of mine, musician friends in London, banking friends in London, who've got no idea about farming, asking me questions and sharing what I'd written. So rather than trying to build from no real followers on Instagram and build out to hit those people you really want to hit, not farmers who might come across you because they're searching, but hit people who are actually not interested but would or don't know that they're interested, Facebook, I found, is actually a very, very useful platform for that.
Yes, questions from Twitter. Again, we had one last night from Tom Martin, Farmer Tom, on Twitter, who said, yeah, you're a great communicator. What platforms do you use and how do you communicate through each one, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, etc.? Do you have a strategy? How can we best communicate the value of farming well to non-farmers? So from what you're saying there, you're actually, because I completely agree with Twitter. It's a great way of farmers connecting with each other.
Yeah.
But actually, in terms of connecting with the outside world, it's really, really tough.
Really limited.
And there is that growth in Instagram. People like pictures, people yes. like videos. What about YouTube?
So this is a question as to how accountable I want to make myself to myself. I've been wondering about making myself accountable to myself. So YouTube, I think, is a brilliant, brilliant platform. I'm fascinated in building, woodwork, metalwork, all these kind of things. And I learn about all of that on YouTube.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say that I'm a professional in those things, but I get by. And there is a little bit of a... there are a few people doing it on YouTube at the moment. There's someone called Tom Pemberton who has a really, really good farming vlog on his dairy farm and puts out a couple of videos a week. And I've been thinking about it for probably 18 months now, and I kind of think I'm at the point where I'm about to bite the bullet and go into that medium as well. So I think that YouTube especially is really...
You've got to do it now.
Well, exactly. Good old
account. Talking about the projects, I don't know how much you can say about it at the moment, but you've told me that you're experimenting with a new farming system focused
yes.
on very low input production methods.
Yes.
How much can you tell me about that?
I personally don't listen to the Archers, but my parents do, and consequently sometimes you hear the Archers.
Absolutely. You're admitting to it.
You love it, really.
I don't love it at harvest when you listen to it for the third time on the Sunday omnibus. We've put in... this is a small project at the moment. We established a herbal lay in May this year from Cotswold Seeds, who've been fantastically useful. I deal with someone called Sam Lane there, but I've dealt with Ian Wilkinson as well, and they are brilliant. Brilliant guys, hugely knowledgeable. Luckily, as the label said, it was a drought-resistant herbal lay. So it had less than 10 mil of rain for the first 2.5 months of its life. So, and considering we've got a really nice stand, it's quite impressive. So this herbal lay is I don't know all the species, but it's got loads of clovers in it. I actually specified to get some annual clovers in there to get some initial kind of nitrogen fixing and fertility and kind of good rooting variations in there. But then it's got chicory, and we did try sandfoin, which is growing. It's not meant to grow on heavy land, but we've got a little bit growing. It looks very pretty. It's all about pretty plants on this farm. And then plantain and things like that. This lay, you would not believe how tremendous it smells. So I'm a bit of a touchy-feely farmer. I think most people who've met me know this now. So for me, a lot of stuff is about the look, the feel, the smell, all those kind of things. So for me, when I go and walk in that herbal lay and it smells so amazing and it looks so beautiful and you've got kind of 10 flowers in a meter square that you can look at and appreciate, and then there's just this buzz of insects, birds swooping in and out, all this kind of stuff, I think, well, crumbs, this has got to be like the... Yeah. This has to be a really good way of farming. So this again was a little bit like a little bit like the Wakelins thing. Right, well, let's do it and work out the rest later. we've got cattle. They're kind of dad's thing.
Okay.
We don't have many. That's what's on, like, a couple of 100 acres of rough grazing that we've got. For a number of years now, we've only ever grown cattle. We've not fattened them. Mm-hmm. Partly because I don't like the idea of chucking nuts into them or chucking food in. And when you start looking at the margins and think, well... We're not a big enough enterprise to be producing food for them, so we buy the food in, and then you'll spend 100 quid on grub on an animal, and that's how much more money it makes, but there's more risk of it dying. So so some of the reason for this herbal layer is it should fatten cattle really nicely, and dare I say it, potentially sheep, but we'll see about that.
Don't do it.
So the idea is that, obviously, we need this to make money. The plan is for it to be in 4 years. There's very, very little grass in there. There's some grass, but it's mostly legumes and herbs and those kind of things. So it will deep root and structure and all these kind of things. But obviously, to make money on it, so you can make a kind of haylage on it, but it's a pain and you don't get the full benefit of it. You get the benefit of grazing on it and mob grazing. These are all things we're looking at hopefully doing. So the idea is that will be in for 4 years, or it probably will have been 3.5 years. And this was actually also tied in with my Wakelands side of things, because essentially we will terminate that after that 4 year period of time, and provided it still exists, it will likely be terminated with glyphosate, which a necessary sin to be zero till. But that will be terminated like that and planted, and we'll receive nothing. And I'm certain we will get a fantastic yield, fantastic protein qualities, the best taste out of it, because it's going to be... Everything's just got to be right for that soil. So in my head, and that's what we're trialling on this small area, is approaching farming in a much more mixed regime. So we do a 4x4 rotation, or this is what I'm thinking in my head, 4 years herbal lay, 4 years cropping. And there, I think you provide you can make money out of your herbal lay, which is the big question, you can't help but make money out of the arable crops after that. And that's just reverting back to a much more standard mixed farming system that would have been seen, especially on a farm like mine, 100 years ago.
Tell me about George Young before George Young was the farmer. When you left school, what was going through your head? And obviously you ended up in banking, but was that your intention?
No, so I studied maths at uni. I don't really know why. Really hard to any young person. Go for economics or mechanics. They're great. Really interesting. yeah, mechanical engineering. I could have swapped onto mechanical engineering before maths got really hard, but I persevered with pure maths. So never mind.
Impressed.
I was good at quantum. That's the one thing I was good at. which was about 10% of my final grade, so it didn't help very much. But anyway, I've always been interested in creative things. So for me, it was music and film. And at uni, I did a huge amount of those, which potentially would also be why I only scraped a second-class degree at Edinburgh University. I seem to remember struggling at doing a lot of production and editing on a large... It was called Bond Idol, like Pop Idol of the time. This really big event for the jazz orchestra that I played in a week before my dissertation was due. So
it's called Living the Uni Life.
Yeah, I think I did... Pulled 3 all-nighters on the trot, and yeah, it was a funny time in my life. That event itself was obviously this perfect mix between music and film. But no, so originally when I came home, I wanted to be in London for the music point of view, and I originally worked for Deutsche Bank, and when that job finished, it moved to Birmingham, and it's fine, but London and Essex are better than Birmingham. Apologies. So I just decided that actually it was then a good time to really try at filmmaking. So I spent probably 2.5-3 years really trying at being an editor at the time. Did loads of running for production houses, that kind of thing. Loads of editing on little kind of really low budget movies and all those kind of bits. But I look back at my work now and you realise that Hollywood is not missing anything by not having me as an editor.
You're putting yourself down.
No, I'm not. They weren't very good movies, but they were not made any better by me. I remember being asked by someone senior in farming years, like when I was like 2 years into the job, saying, well, it just sounds like you're going to get really bored at farming, which quite frankly is probably true, but thankfully farming is such a vastly wide spectrum. Exactly. There are always other things that you can go into. So,
yeah. What do you get up to away from farming? How do you relax, for example?
Lately? it's been quite full on this year. I had stepped away from doing music about 3 years ago because commutes into London and things like and coming back home at 5 o'clock on a Sunday morning were less fun.
You must still play a bit though.
But so just recently I've started getting back into that. So I've started playing with a few more bands again, which is good. That is a nice release.
Yeah.
And I am looking to try and build out a little kind of wood workshop and metal workshop. I love kind of making things. Yeah. And I think there's nothing better than a hobby if it's something that means you can go and work on something and then you look up and 9 hours have passed.
Yeah,
that's absolutely. To me, that is ideal relaxation. Maybe it's an age thing. I don't know. I can't find I can sit in front of the telly like I used to. I have to go and be making something. And the other thing, which is why I'd like to be doing stuff like woodwork, is farming is so long term. There was a naive part of me that thought, you know, 5 years ago, that thought with farming's fun because at least you've got a yearly cycle. And then you become a farmer and realise that actually I'm planning for 5, 10, 50 years in advance and would like tiny little projects that I can complete in a weekend and feel really proud of myself about.
Let's talk about Brexit.
Oh, lovely.
I know, you want to really.
My favourite.
How can arable farmers prepare for life after Brexit when so little is known about the political and policy climate that they will be working in?
I genuinely have no idea.
Mm.
My strategy, rightly or wrongly, we are not spending any money. We are farming as cheaply as we possibly can. Obviously, we've got boosted grain prices at the moment, somewhat inflated by the pound, more inflated by, obviously, supply and demand globally and all these things. Everyone's had a shocker. I don't think we can be at all convinced that we're going to be looking at good prices next year. You can hope. Just simply the price rise in fertiliser this year. I mean, it's so shockingly large. And again, maybe that's my lack of experience as a farmer. I'm sure these price jumps have occurred in the past, but just looking for someone who's such a figures man when it comes to farming, you look at these things, it's quite shocking. So for me, it's kind of not at all looking at changing my machinery, keeping all that as up to date as possible, majoring a lot of my brain power on diversification options and being confident that at least whatever happens, the UK is not going to grind to a halt, even if we've got lots of trade deal problems and things like that. So I think, unfortunately, and this should not be the case, but I think unfortunately diversification is king in a time like this. And then also this is partly whereby, at least if you are producing some food crops rather than commodity crops, you are not so reliant on a global market. And you can have carved out some degree of local market, which will also always be there. There will always be an affluent portion of British society, no matter what happens. But again, it's such a small part of where we are at the moment in our farming operation.
Vegans. I asked George before I came here to give me some topics that he wanted to vent about. And normally I only talk to livestock farmers about the vegan community, and I've received fairly predictable answers most of the time. But George, you have a different perspective, and you think that farmers should be embracing the vegan community rather than becoming distanced from them.
Yes.
Explain.
I love veganism. I think it is one of the best movements to be occurring in food that has happened for a long, long time. And hugely different and better than vegetarianism. Although some vegetarians are still in that mindset. But the really cool thing about vegans is they actually care about their food, and they care about every little bit of their food. Now, I obviously disagree about eating meat because, quite frankly, I really like a bacon sandwich and I really like a steak. I don't think we should be having bacon sandwiches every single morning and steak for tea every single day. But, you know, I wouldn't want to be zero meat personally. However, I mean, again, by dint of my social circles, I've got a number of friends who are vegan.
Yeah.
And the really cool thing is, like, these aren't the kind of aggressive vegans that you see on the news, or the ones who go and post silly adverts in papers and they're doing kind of schoolyard tactics at promoting veganism. But these are people who are just genuinely fascinated in how their food is produced. And it started by them saying, I think there's a bit of a problem with this meat industry, because it's obvious, and it's a big obvious thing. But you talk to them further, and I had a really, really good friend of mine, old friend, musician. Him and his wife have turned vegan. And I was chatting to him, and he was asking me, he'd done so much research that he'd realised actually that it wasn't just the livestock side that's got these kind of problems, but it's the farming side. This isn't farming with an issue. This is how farming has been developed by government. It's the government pointing farmers in direction. That's the thing that's flawed. And so people are talking, you talk to vegans, they're interested in why are you or are you not doing companion cropping? Why are you or aren't you organic or zero till? These people, they know all these phrases. These are people who know nothing about farming, who've done the research to find out about farming. Now, they put two and two together and made 4.2. They're not a million miles off, but they haven't, they haven't got the full answer, but they're interested. And this is actually whereby the platform, the social media platforms, and especially YouTube, are the keys to be able to get those guys really to understand how farming works. It's beginning to be a big enough movement. I'm pretty certain there's a tiny, tiny portion of that other than the militant ones. Most of them are just people who care about where their food comes from, including where all the rest of their food comes from, not just the meat. So if we can get them on side, they can start changing the government's mind about things. The simplest thing in terms of veganism is, they keep on going and campaigning at large abattoirs. I think, there's a reason why we have large abattoirs now, because government have made it untenable for smaller abattoirs to exist, which is ridiculous. What is wrong with killing on farm? For me, it's a complete no-brainer. Mobile abattoirs. Great. Let's have a little bit more sensible kind of relaxation of rules around hygiene and things. I think what everyone's so worried about, there's nothing wrong with having gut bacteria and all these kind of things. Everyone wants absolute cleanliness everywhere. It's ridiculous. But, the simple thing for me would be like, if vegan campaigning brought an end to the large, stressy abattoir with hour, 2 hour, 3 hour commutes for livestock in cattle trailers, and instead enabled small-scale killing on-farm, where they're in their own environment and they're killed quickly and unstressed, which is going to make the meat taste 1,000 times better as well. These are all fantastic things. This is why we shouldn't at all be against these vegans. Now, I can understand that if you're getting combated by a vegan who's complaining about your practices, which are practices instilled by governments, I can see what, you know, vegans are targeting the wrong people. They should be targeting government, not farmers. But I really think we're missing a trick by not really engaging with those guys and getting them on farm and getting them to see the fantastic stuff that we're doing. And yeah, so I'm a big fan of the vegan movement.
Brilliant. Well, that's a topic for Twitter to take on. Brilliant, George. Thank you. So I think we'll leave it there. But it's great. Been fascinating to talk to you.
I'm a bit of a nutter, if you hadn't realised.
That was arable farmer George Young talking to me at his farm in Essex. Rumour has it, and he's going to kill me for this, but you can also catch George on First Dates Hotel on Channel 4 at Series 3, Episode 3. You can catch up on all four, at least for the next couple of weeks or so. I've been your host, Ben Eagle, and you can catch me on Twitter and Instagram at Benji_Eagle. Benji is B-E-N-J-Y. Next time, we're featuring pigs on the podcast for the first time. I'll be talking to Mark Haywood from Dingley Dell Farm in Suffolk. I hope you can join me then.